Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
So first of all, we have Mandisa Thomas, who is the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers. She currently serves on the boards for American Atheist and American Humanist Association and facilitates the Morrow GA chapter of Recovering from Religion. In 2019, Mandisa was named the Freedom from Religion Foundation's Free Thought Heroine, which is a pretty amazing thing, and was the recipient of the Secular Student Alliance Backbone Award. So thank you, Mandisa, for being here and welcome.
Thank you once again for having me.
We also have with us this evening Candice R. Gorham, M-A-L-P-C-S. She's a licensed professional mental health counselor. She's also a former ordained minister turned atheist slash humanist activist. She's a researcher and a writer on issues related to race and religion. She's a member of the Black Humanist Alliance Advisory Board, the Secular Therapy Project, and the Clergy Project. Candice is also the author of The Ebony Exodus Project, Why Some Black Women Are Walking Out of Religion and Others Should Too. Candice and Mandisa were two of the five fierce humanists in the July-August 2018 issue of The Humanist magazine. I got to read that article, that whole magazine. I was like from cover to cover. It was really, really good. And both were featured on the cover, and they were the main topic, the main articles. Also joining us tonight is the executive director of Recovering from Religion, Gail Jordan, and the president and founder of Recovering from Religion, Dr. Dale Ray. Everyone, welcome.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks. Hey, welcome everyone. I thank you for those wonderful introductions, Eric and Amaya. I'm happy here too. When I was approached about doing this, this talk, I realized that I had to have one of my best cohorts in this movement do this with me. And because I am a practitioner and organizer in this movement, and have also worked with those who have a more clinical background, it was best for us to combine forces, especially on this subject, this subject this evening. Now, we are we are here to discuss something that is at the forefront of our current events. We are now in a state, another cycle of racial and civil unrest, which has now expanded from the United States to the world. We have the entire world shouting and stating and exclaiming that Black Lives Matter. Now, this is a subject that some people may not think pertain to the secular community, or that it may not affect as many of us as they may think. However, they would be incorrect. And so, in order for us to discuss how these things have affected us in our everyday lives, how they've affected us societally, as well as how they can impact our mental, overall health, it was important for us to discuss how these things actually pertain to us within our communities. And I'm happy to have Daryl and Gail join us for the special session because it is, we find it's extremely important. Candice, before I get into the session, are there any words you wanted to add?
No, I'm just ready to go. Let's go, man. Let's get at it. Talk about some racism. Let's go.
Yeah. So
and
this.
Man of hell.
Yes. So this discussion, this topic may be a bit sensitive. It may be a bit uncomfortable for some of you, but guess what? As uncomfortable as it is for you to hear it, just try to imagine how uncomfortable it has been for those of us from direct African descent to have experienced this, to have been affected by this in our society. And as we come into the non-religious community, and as we still have to deal with it within our own community. So we want y'all to put yourselves in our shoes for a moment. but also try to understand how this may impact you more than you realize. So now I'm going to share our screen. I'm going to share my screen for the PowerPoint. Going back to the beginning here. So the title of this, the title here is How Racism and Injustice Affects Our Mental Health. And so I'm just going to get into a bit about us. Now, we had the introductions already, but this is the cover of the Humanist magazine from 2018, the July-August issue. And as you can see, there's myself and there's Candace there, along with Sakivu Hutchinson. Some of you may know her. Some of you may know Bridget Crutchfield, affectionately known as Bria. And also Liz Ross. And there's also the five of us as we were standing together at last year's Women of Color Beyond Belief conference, which was sponsored in part by Recovering from Religion. Thank you to all of you for your support. And what's important about this is when Candace wrote her book, I remember when she first reached out in 2011. And we had the conversation because she was putting her book together, The Ebony Exodus Project, which has been extremely instrumental in understanding the trajectory of religion and how it impacts Black women in particular. And so I appreciate the longstanding relationship and working relationship that she and I have. It's also like a sisterhood, because really, as it's more than just about building community, it's also about building up evidence-based resources for people who need to understand more about what we go through. So Candace, if you'd like to take a few more minutes to say a few words about this.
Yeah, I think, like Mandisa was saying, that sisterhood, that word sisterhood there is a big deal in terms of finding a sort of pulling together a movement, pulling together people. Obviously, you know, if you think about like Black humanists, you know, Black non-believers trying to, you know, start a movement, start something for ourselves. But then, like she's saying, Black women specifically, you know, finding a group of us that really were able to pull together and support each other. And like she's saying, you know, seeing that we can kind of call on each other and really depend on each other to, you know, support each other. And, you know, anytime there's some, you know, just, yeah, that sisterhood is such a big deal. And you know, when you one of the big, like with my book, something that it constantly blows me away, you know, is that still all these years later, you know, I still get random, you know, messages from random people, you know, that'll talk about how instrumental, like you said, that just that book was to them, to say, wow, look at these other Black women out there that, you know, like that they related to that experience and how much that book spoke to them, or those other, you know, hearing those other stories spoke to them. And so as we go into this presentation, further and further into this presentation, there's something to be said about that sense of isolation. You know, obviously we're talking here, and you know, right now we're talking in the context of religion, but even outside of, you know, just what does it mean to be Black in America, there's a profound sense of isolation. There's a profound sense of, I don't have anybody else who understands what I'm going through. And so, you know, we can talk all day long about, you know, why these, you know, protests have erupted to the extent that they have. It's like, once you see other people feeling and experiencing the same pain that you have been experiencing, that really begins to gush out in an extreme way. And you know, and sort of, it's like on a microcosm, it's sort of like the five of us, you know, the five of us, we kind of pull together, and it's like, oh my gosh, the five of us, you know, really support each other, pull together as, you know, five, you know, female Black humanist activists you know, and then, like I said, my book, you know, other women read it and they're like, oh my God, look at this. It really means a lot to me. And it's something about that. And then, like I said, you know, now we're looking at this explosion of outpouring of something amazing that's going on. And there's something to be said about this when you begin to see other people experiencing what you're experiencing and going through what you're going through. I mean, it can just really be an outpouring and explosion. So, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but yeah, the connection, that sisterhood and the connection is what I'm getting at. It's really a big deal in terms of us. And, you know, yeah. Like Mandisa said, it's just really been amazing that we've been able to maintain this relationship all these years. It means a lot to me.
Absolutely. And that is what building our community is about. Usually, like, I can never start a presentation speaking on the challenges that Black atheists face without discussing not just religion in the Black community, but also the impact that racism has had on our society and also the Black community. And this is what we're going to get a bit more in depth into for this session. So we can't start, we cannot start this presentation also without explaining, without going into some historical and institutional aspects. So we have to talk about how racism has affected. How did we get to this point? You know, how did we get here to, you know, the point where there are some of everybody throughout the world shouting Black Lives Matter? Again, this is, as I said before, it's not the first time this has happened. This is a cycle of things that are happening. And now there are some people who, you know, who really want to know what's going on. How did we get here now? But it didn't just start yesterday and did not just start with the murders of the Black folks this year. It was a succession of things that have been taking place for a number of years. But we have to understand the four levels of racism and how they have impacted our society and why we see a disproportionate number of Black folks who suffer and who have died at the hands of law enforcement and other institutional factors. So it goes back to when Africans were brought to this country, enslaved Africans, and how there were laws and perceptions that were, placed strongly on ensuring the enslavement of Africans. It must be understood that these laws and structures were put in place with no thought of the enslaved Africans and their descendants ever being free. So we were supposed to be perpetual slaves, even to this day. And so we have the most damaging levels of racism being institutional and structural. So as I just said, they were these laws were written. Race was established by law in this country, classifying folks. But then you also have it as to you have it as a practice during which filtered down during the period of legal enslavement, and then once that ended and once Reconstruction ended in the 1800s, that was also instituted by Jim Crow laws, which were legal laws on the books and which absolutely gave the dominant power the actual right to go in and destroy and terrorize businesses and people of color, i.e. Black folks. So it was the institutional part, discriminatory treatments, policies and practices, and also systems that were put in place that actually blocked out and diminished and tried to turn Blacks into a permanent underclass and actually sanctioned that they would be treated any way that others saw fit. Now, those personal prejudices and beliefs that people had are one thing, and interpersonal. I think, you know, it's safe to say that many people may have, you know, prejudicial feelings towards other people. However, when they are enacted into law and actually put into practice, that is where the institutional factors come in, and that is what affects people economically. That's also what affects people on a societal level. And before I forget, you know, there's also a really good documentary to see is 13, which is based on the 13th Amendment. Now, I will say that as a kid, you know, I was raised that very woke Black nationalist child who, you know, who learned about a lot of things. I read Assata Shakur's book when I was a teenager, and that was the first time I was given, you know, a better understanding to the 13th Amendment, which reads, neither slavery or involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for which the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States. So this was a legal loophole around slavery. And as we see the correctional system as we do today, it tells a very, very disproportionate as to who is in that system. And how it feeds into that, in that cycle of racism that has impacted Black communities in particular in a way that that has been very, very damaging to our community and has actually led to us sort of being in the state where we are. Now I have this shared segment with Candace here. So if you'd like to add anything to that, or if Daryl or Gail would like to add anything.
Well, I do want to jump in here real briefly. As a person who's experienced this going clear back to the civil rights movement, there's something I wish I'd been introduced to early on in my life. And that's, how do you step into another person's shoes and understand what's going on to them within our legal and institutional structure? And that has been kind of a struggle because I'm, you know, who I am. I'm an old white guy. I don't have firsthand access to some of that. So I found it's very important as I listen to what you're telling us tonight, Mandisa, how do I get into your shoes? How do I get in Candace's shoes and see what would it be like if every time I see a cop to have cold sweats and wonder if I'm the next one victim from them. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. And that's what I think the value of this can be for all of us, no matter what our status in this society is.
I think when Mandisa mentioned the 13th documentary, I remember when it first came out, everybody was saying like, don't watch it until you're ready to, you know, like you're going to be angry. You know, you're going to be angry when that thing goes off. Like, don't watch it until you're ready to like really sit down. And it was so true. Like, I was crying and I was mad and I was angry and I was just like, even though it wasn't necessarily stuff that I didn't know, but there was plenty of stuff that I didn't know, but I mean, I was, and so how to relate to that? I don't know. I mean, you gotta like really immerse yourself in this information and let yourself feel angry all the time. Like, I think that's the thing is, I think white people cut it off before they start to feel that much anger because they start saying like, I don't understand why Black people are so angry all the time, or, you know, that it's not that big of a deal, or, you know, they start to kind of wall things off before they feel the intense emotion. And, you know, one of my friends, she's German, and she lives in Germany, but I met her face to face. She, like, when I used to live in Bermuda, she couch surfed at my house, so I know her face to face, and we've maintained friendship since then. And she was commenting on something on, you know, since all this has happened. And, you know, her comment was whatever it was, and I kind of LOL'd, and she was like, you know, surprised that I laughed, and she was like, aren't, you know, I would be so angry about that. And I was like, girl, I'm so mad all the time. Like, you know, it's like the Hulk, you know, like the secret is that we're angry all the time, you know? And so it's like that. I don't know how to, other than to say, you know, give in to every time you expose, every time you come across something that you have a negative emotional reaction to, give in to that negative emotional reaction and say, yes, this makes me angry. Yes, this makes me whatever, whatever, because that's how we feel all the time, you know? And then how do we figure, you know, how do we get by with it? How do we deal with it? I don't know. You know, we go back behind our closed doors and say, I hate white people. They get on my fucking nerves. You know, like, that's how we get over it. Like, I don't know how we get over it. We just live with it. We just live with it. You know, what I think about, you know, what people have to realize is, like, you know, people get surprised about, like, racism still existing or what. It's like, you know, Jim Crow and all this stuff that we're talking about. Like, these people are still alive. Like, you realize that, like, these grannies and great-grannies and stuff, like, these people are still alive. Like, you understand that these people have not died out. You know, not all of them anyway. I was telling somebody the story the other day about how, this has been a few years. I mean, my daughter's 16 now, but when she was about, like, maybe 3, so it's been a while, but she's about 3, I was taking her to Walmart, back when Walmart had the little photo studios, and I was taking her to Walmart to get her pictures, and she was super cute, you know, cleaned up, she had a cute little dress and stuff. I kid you not, little old white lady stops me, oh my gosh, she's so cute, she's so pretty, oh Lord, you know, oh. And she goes, I always did think y'all did such a good job of keeping them so clean. And I just walked away. That woman actually looked at me and my child and said, y'all did such a good, I always thought y'all did such a good job of keeping them so clean. And I just had to walk away, or else I was gonna flip out in Walmart in front of my 3-year-old child. So I just had to walk away. Like, you know, like, this type of stuff just bubbles out of people. Like, she thought she was being kind. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, how do we deal with it? It's just there. It's just there every day. And, you know, the anger that we feel, like you're saying, like, when you ride past police and stuff, that pit, you know, that pit that comes up in your stomach, it's just there, you know, it's just there. It's like carrying your purse or carrying your wallet, you know, it's just there. So if you want to know what it's like, let yourself feel negative emotion every time, you know, don't cut it off and say, you know, don't kind of like block it off and say, I don't understand why black people are so angry all the time. Or, you know, this doesn't make sense, you know, or, you know, if they would just, you know, like, don't cut it off. Don't, just let yourself feel that negative moment and sit with it every single time. Every time you see it, every time you see something, every time a black person tells you something, just sit with it and just roll with it. Like, if you really want to, because you're going to be exhausted. Like, that's what happens is white people get exhausted with the anger and the frustration and the irritability. They get exhausted with it and they can't understand. But I had a, before we move on to the next one, I had this thing, this book that I about how it impacts our society. I don't know if anybody has ever read this book, The Heart of Whiteness. It's called The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege by Robert Jensen. And I'll give you guys the I'll give them the information so they can post it. But anyway, he made this line that I thought, he wrote this thing that I thought was really good. I just want to. So he said, somewhere down in our guts, we understand that in an oppressive system such as white supremacy, the unearned privileges with which we live are based on the suffering of others. We know that we have things because others don't. we may not want to give voice to that feeling, but it is impossible to ignore completely. And it doesn't feel good, in part because to be fully human is to seek communion with others, not separation from them. And one cannot find that connection under conditions in which unjust power brings unearned privilege. To be fully human is to reject a system that conditions your pleasure on someone else's pain. And so I thought that was really interesting. It's like, if you are conditioning your pleasure on someone else's pain, even if you're not doing it, you know, knowingly,
intentionally, mm-hmm.
you're really not ever able to sort of actualize your humanity.
The way that you're describing this, I'm hearing it, and I kind of am imagining myself in that position, and I won't know where this next microaggression is going to come from. This next aggression is going to come from, and so I almost feel like I would never let my guard down. Is that similar to what you're saying?
Perfect. Absolutely. Exactly. That is something, you know, we are raised, especially like, you know, say my generation, you think about like, you know, my parents' generation or our grandparents' generation, it was ingrained, you don't trust white people. You don't trust white people, period. You don't trust them. You know, you think about like, you know, our parents and our grandparents who genuinely grew up, you know, civil rights, Jim Crow, blah, blah, blah. You don't trust white people, period. You know, and that is what it is. And so that sense of like, don't let your guard down, absolutely. You know, and I'm just giving you straight information. I'm giving it to you raw right now. You know, and that is a thing, you know, and that you will hear quite frequently in the Black community. You know, because, yeah, you just never know where it's going to come from the next time. You know, like I said, I mean, that's a punch in the gut when you got your beautiful, well-made up little child and a sweet old lady comes to tell you that your child is so beautiful. And then out of nowhere, I thought y'all did such a good job of keeping them clean. You know, like that's... Thank goodness my child didn't understand what that meant, you know, and it just, like you said, little things. I don't know if she understood what she meant. I'm sure she knew once upon a time, you know.
Yeah, it kind of goes to how she views the world in a sense, you know, where she was surprised that the baby was clean.
Clean.
It's
right. You're surprised my child is clean. Anyway,
right.
On to the next slide.
Right. So as we go into this, and I'm gonna add to what Candace said about the extreme mistrust for white people, and this is, we're speaking as a collective here, but the psychosis and the psyche of racism takes on a number of, it affects us in a number of ways and not necessarily overtly. It's not so as overt as some white person saying the N-word to us anymore, you know, or it's not as implicit as someone or explicit as someone actually physically holding us down. So it is a whole system. I don't want to say ecosystem, but it's like, it's a whole system in itself. And how we got to this point is, so there is this paradox within the Black community that as much as there is a mistrust for white people, because there have been so many things that they have committed against not just other marginalized communities, but also themselves, there is also this subconscious want to emulate white supremacy that we deal with in our communities. And this comes from psychologically being conditioned to think that Black is ugly, Black is bad. Like, you might think, don't I keep my child clean? Like, wow, my child must, someone might internalize that. So there have been generations of Black folks that have subconsciously internalized this idea that Black is subhuman, or that is less than, because of conditions that were forced on us. And even though the Black community has a long history of resilience and success and such, but even in these conditions, we're still having to deal with, with workplace discrimination, with other socioeconomic issues that, even well-dressed or well-spoken Black folks could still get shot or killed by law enforcement because they don't care what your education level is. They don't care what your background is. All they see is your skin color. And so this, again, has been woven into the fabric, especially of within these United States. Now, there are issues with, across the diaspora, across the world, with, with people of darker skin. But as these, I contend, and I'm sure Candace would agree, that there is definitely trauma and a post-traumatic stress disorder from having been enslaved and having to deal with segregation, having to deal with terrorism, and having to deal with all of these these disadvantages within our communities. And there is, especially as we see with this pandemic, we see that there are more Black folks that are affected by the COVID-19 pandemic more than any other demographic. And that is because medical facilities in our communities are still subpar. There is still a limit on healthcare, and then we do have higher risks. So all of this poses the system of racism, institutional and structural, has just created a huge stress and mental factor on our communities in general. And so you see a breakdown here that doesn't seem as overt, but that it has had a long-lasting effect that many people may not even realize that they're going through or that they're affected by. But it does play more than just it does more than just place your physical health in danger. And so with that, I'd like for Candace to expound a bit more on that.
One of the things you kind of said something a second ago, it's not coming back to me right now, but it made me think about something that as far as how we as a community may deal with some of this stuff. I know like something
the internalized, the internalized supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily the internalized supremacy, but responding to it. How, like, right. One of the ways that we have historically tried to deal with it, I know something that, I've sort of heard before, which is this idea that, sort of like, I'm going to be harder on you, sort of like a parent might say to their child, I'm going to be hard on you because the world is going to be harder on you.
Mm-hmm,
and I
right.
need to prepare you for the world.
Mm-hmm.
So then this is how you end up with parents, spanking their children or, imposing really harsh consequences on their children, because the mentality is, I need to toughen you up inside of the home, because when you leave the home, it's going to be real tough outside of the home. We've seen videos in the past of, I don't know if you remember it, Mandisa, but there was a video, it came out a few years ago where it was something like this, where some Black man had been shot, and there was some rioting, and some kid it was like a teenager was out there in the riot, and the parent, the mom,
yes,
had
I remember
recorded
that.
Herself, and she went out there and was beating the kid in the street.
Yep.
And she was saying, I would rather beat my kid in the street so that he doesn't get shot by the police. Like, I would rather beat him myself so that he would come home and understand that, like, you know, it'd be better for me to beat him and he lives than for him to be out here in the street and then get shot by the police. And so this sort of, you know, it kind of creates this, you know, it puts us in a really perverse bind, right? That we gotta be so harsh on our own selves. Mm-hmm. Because now the only way we could kind of protect ourselves from the racist world is to be nasty to our own selves in the hope that that's going to kind of like, you know, do some sort of reverse psychology to kind of keep ourselves in our house and protect ourselves from y'all. You know, that was just one thing that came to my mind. But this, you know, as far as the racism itself, I mean, you know, just in general, like you're saying, I mean, the PTSD of it all, you know, you just never really get to, I mean, obviously the basics of, like, you know, depression and anxiety and those types of things, you know, that come about from it. You know, it impacts us, our kids so much. I mean, you know, my daughter goes to a school that's something like 65% white, 70% white, something like that. I mean, she comes home with stories about some teacher said something about, you know, black people ought to be thankful for slavery or else they wouldn't be here. Or, I mean, you know, like, just crazy stories about racism and stuff. And I think, well, she was telling me about how the teacher who made that comment in a class, it was her friend who was in the class that comment was made to, that the teacher that made that class. So her friend is coming back and telling her, you won't believe this comment that my teacher made. And it impacted her friend so much so that, like, he ended up staying out of class for like 2 days. He didn't come to school for like 2 days because he was so, you know, hurt and distraught and, you know, scared to go to class. I don't know, you know, but it has, you know, you have to think about on a significant level. You know, obviously there's the internalized stuff, there's the day-to-day things, there's the things that you can't see, you know, and every time there's things like shootings and stuff, I mean, I know even for myself, I get nervous, you know, when I see police. And I'm not doing anything illegal. You know, my tags on my car are good. You know, I'm not speeding. I'm just in the grocery store shopping. But I see cops, and I don't want to see cops. They make me nervous, you know. Right. And you know, this racism, I mean, just sometimes I get to a place where during times like this where I just feel like, I just want to be among my own people where I feel like I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to be looked at funny. I don't have to worry about, am I going to be called a name? I don't have to be worried about a cop doing anything. Like, you know, it's times like this become so overwhelming to so many people. And it just becomes a this chronic stress. You know, like, you know, as we see here, I mean, that chronic stress, as we know, can have a lifelong impact on our health, our physical health, even when you're the healthiest person. You know, I mean, this is going to impact your cardiovascular health, your health in every kind of way. And like I said, you know, from a mental health perspective, you know, I'm a big proponent of, I think Amaya, you might have said everybody should see a therapist at least once in their life or something like that. I'm a big proponent of everybody seeing a therapist at least once in their life, you know, and unfortunately, you know, the Black community can be a little bit resistant to, you know, being a mental health professional. They can be a little bit resistant to taking medication. But I'm a big proponent of seeing a therapist taking an antidepressant, taking an anti-anxiety medication if necessary, because it's a rough world out there for us, you know. And so you add on top of that, on top of the issues that, you know, add on top of that resistance to the treatments that are available to us, you know, you kind of have this double whammy. But, you know, like I said, I'm a big proponent of, I mean, I might be a little bit biased as a mental health professional, but I definitely recommend that everybody, you know, experience it once in a while, even if you don't have any major issues going on, even if it's just, you know, because I just want somebody to talk to.
Right. And that is definitely a part of understanding the systemic and structural and institutional racism and the aspects of, you know, receiving that help even within our community, because for so long it was actually denied as an option. It wasn't even considered an option for, you know, for a lot of Black folks. So in trying to get to that point, that is also how racism has affected mental health, especially amongst Black folks, the fact that it has taken so long for people to realize that it is an option. So, you know, that's also what we're talking about here. So moving on to the next slide and the challenges of addressing racial injustice, especially amongst non-believers. Now we consider ourselves a more progressive community because we have liberated ourselves from our religious belief. We no longer believe in this oppressive God. We no longer believe in that particular entity that seems to gain pleasure off of our pain, right? That Candace just said. We realize that this entity that many of us have let go of. And now I consider myself a bit fortunate, more fortunate than others, that I didn't have to recover from religious indoctrination. I did have to unlearn indoctrination, but, you know, not that part of it. But the challenges of addressing racial injustice are oftentimes the white privilege elephant in the room when it comes to the secular community. Now, it's no secret that most of the community, as we see visible, is still predominantly white. It is still predominantly white represented, and most of the community prides itself on its, you know, its intellectual capability, you know, how well learned and how read they are, especially as it pertains to philosophy and as it pertains to the God concept and religion and how harmful it can be. However, there tends to be sometimes a willful ignorance of other societal issues as it pertains to institutional and structural racism that has allowed this sense of the system of white privilege to flourish, even if you are, you know, even if you are secular and non-religious, there is still that aspect of whiteness that may prevent you from seeing other, you know, other areas of what other people have gone through systemically in this country. We also deal with a number of people who are too colorblind, you know. They're so stuck up on race being such a social construct and that it isn't a real construct, that we're all human beings, which technically is true, scientifically it's true, but we cannot ignore how the classification of race has, you know, has affected all of us in this country, but has also affected Black folks disproportionately. Those social and societal structures have been very, very damaging, have had real and long-term consequences for our communities. And so, you know, ignoring that part tends to be a huge challenge in having this discussion, even though we're supposed to be more enlightened as a community. But we realize that in our in our upbringings and also in our societal perspectives, how much people actually don't know, or they haven't considered once they've started engaging other people. There's also attempts to center whiteness, especially when we start talking about issues that pertain to the Black community and other people of color and other marginalized communities. Well, I'm white and I go through this. There's no, you know, again, white supremacy has affected everyone. It has affected everyone adversely. However, again, when you attempt to center the already predominant culture or the already predominant perception, because you might be afraid of hearing about another perspective, that tends to be done on a number of levels. And again, I as an organizer and as someone who has engaged with other leadership in this community, I could share some experiences about the dismissiveness that we encounter, you know, in dealing with this subject in this community. And as the burden of proof falling on us, falling on Black folks or people of color, you know, people wanting to know what's going on. They want to know how can they learn more. But when, you know, when we talk about it and when we're frank, when we're honest about it, you know, people take personal offense. You know, it's as if we're speaking directly to you that you did something wrong, which most of us aren't. It's about understanding what has happened societally and what has happened systemically, and that there is some accountability on the white collective on what has happened to people. So it goes around in a circle. It tends to go, you know, it tends to go round and round and round. It's as if the cycle never ends, because people are now, it's good now that we are having more of these discussions, because people do want to learn more now. But people have said they wanted to learn more before, and even when the information is presented very, very tactfully and very fair, you have folks who, because they are unwilling to step into those shoes of the folks who have lived it and the folks who have, and to actually see, you know, the evidence and the statistics, it can be scary and it's understandable, but try to understand again what we live and what we have, you know, what we have gone through, and also how it affects all of us. So we continue to have this cycle within our community that, you know, that doesn't seem to think, where many don't seem to think that issues of racial injustice are relevant to state church separation, or they aren't relevant to overcoming religious indoctrination, which is entirely untrue. So, you know, and this is the type of thing that we tend to deal with a lot. And so I know Gail is still here. Gail, are you still here? Oh, I thought she was.
I'm here.
Okay. So, I mean, as I have found that, you know, Recovering from Religion has been just an awesome organization in understanding, you know, I'd like to get your perspective on this aspect of our community.
Well, Mandisa, as I've listened to you talk, Mandisa and I have been friends for coming up on 10 years now. And what I have learned, and Mandisa has taught me this, but she's taught it in a kind and patient way. It isn't enough to be an ally. We're all allies. We're all wonderful. Yes, we're all people. We're so skeptical. We're so open-minded. We know that this is, we know what history is. And so now we're all on this equal playing field, and it is not enough to be an ally. We have to be advocates. What I have also learned, and really and truly, this is probably the only thing I'm going to say in this whole presentation, because I have learned with my privilege to shut my mouth and to listen. I've learned to shut my mouth and open my page, shut my mouth and open my organization, shut my mouth and open my wallet. We have to be intentional about making this progress. And when I can't imagine the feeling when white people go to black people and say, teach me about this. What can we do? Help us help you. I can't, that's the most patronizing. I think these are well-intentioned people, but until we remove ourselves from our position of privilege and think, gosh, wonder what it's like to have this sentiment expressed repeatedly. Oh, I just wish we could, I wish we could help. We know how to help. Stop asking black people to educate us about how we can help, for one thing. There's 1,000 books. I brought a couple of books off my shelf because I wanted to endorse a couple of them. This one changed my thinking. This is a professor in Emory in Atlanta. This book changed my thinking because we are understanding that it's not black rage that's causing the problem. It's white rage. It's white rage at progress. And you see that. You all know this. I'm rambling because I'm agitated and I'm emotional about this issue. We have to be intentional about this, and we have to be more than just open-minded, peaceful allies. We have to be advocates. We have to be aggressive about trying to resolve this. We have to educate ourselves, and we have to do the things we already know to do, which is elevate those voices of people of color, which is support the organization, support black non-believers, support any organization of people of color, Hispanic non-believers, anything we can, we know to do this. And so I'm going to now take my own advice and shut my mouth and turn it back over. But Lisa, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And I just feel, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Oh, you're welcome. I think this is good for us to be interactively having this conversation once again. Of course, Candace and I are leading this as, you know, practitioners and as a mental health therapist and as an author. It's important for us to, you know, to have this conversation. So confronting our biases, and I know we confronting them.
Can I just jump in real quick?
This is your section, Candace. Go for it.
Well, as far as like why we can't, you know, one of the reasons why it's hard for this community to, you know, deal with racial injustice like this, somebody in the chat right now that's just having a whole fit about, you know, sort of censoring their Irish heritage and how their Irish history, you know, is, I guess maybe they're trying to equate it to the African experience. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, the Irish became white somehow, right? You know, somehow they became white. If they were other initially, somehow they became white. Somehow they became okay. Because they're certainly not black, you know, they're certainly not of the despised groups today. So, you know, this is the reason why it's hard to fight this kind of fight. When you have people who, again, in this movement, you know, right now, we're in a space trying to discuss this sort of thing, and they just still absolutely cannot stand it.
Right.
My people. But now my people experience the same thing. Just, you know, your people are white. In 2020, your people are white. They are not being shot in the streets. You know what I'm saying? They are not being beat down. They are not having their necks held to the ground for almost 9 minutes. So, you know, it's not the same. And if we want this movement, the non-religious, the humanist, if we're supposed to be the enlightened ones, you know, we need to be the ones listening, you know, and this is exactly what Mandisa started out saying, right? That we start out thinking, and like humanists and stuff start out thinking like, oh, I've gotten rid of my religion, and so I'm much more enlightened, I'm further along than everybody else. But then, you know, we still come back around and people still have those sorts of mentalities and those sorts of attitudes and that sort of thing.
So, right. Anyway.
I say to say that.
But yes, and this goes into confronting our biases, even as it pertains to other groups and other nationalities who may have experienced discrimination in some way. Now, no one here is denying that. I'm a history buff, so I know that there have been, you know, I've read up on, you know, the fact that there have been, like you said, you know, the Irish have went through their, you know, periods of discrimination within the United States or in, and, you know, in other parts of the world. So have other cultures. But when we are talking about systemically over the course of centuries, having, you know, having been subjugated and oppressed by other factors, mainly, you know, mainly motivated by how the darker you are, the worse you're treated. And this has resulted in generational wealth accumulated by the United States based off of centuries of enslaved labor, centuries of exploiting people. And again, with the mentality that was sanctioned by the Catholic Church, that these darker skinned people were never gonna be free. They were gonna be perpetual slaves forever and ever. And so there is a much more detailed psychosis that people need to understand about that and how this relates to the issues that we deal with today. So we have to confront our biases and also how religious indoctrination may play a role in that. Because there was a saying that the most segregated day of the week is Sunday. And we also must remember that the Ku Klux Klan, which is a terrorist organization, prides itself on also being what? A Christian organization. And so these things very much overlap. They very much go hand in hand. And it's important that, as we stated here, that recovering from religion also includes recovering, or at least trying to recover from those ideals and from those systems that come along with them, like racism, classism, and sexism, because again, you find that they mirror in these religious ideals. And so, yes, Candace, this is mostly your slide though.
This is mostly my slide.
Yes, because as a mental health professional, right, and as a counselor, I think it's important that people understand how mentally they're carrying this baggage.
I think, what we're talking about, all of it is, I think all of this rolls into, you know, everything that we've been talking about, right? That if you're going to confront your biases, you got to be willing to self-reflect in an honest way, right? When I'm working with my client, self-reflection when I'm talking to them, when I'm working with them, one of the things I like to do is ask them to sort of list what are things that they say are their values. And then I like to have them, you know, sort of also talk about their behaviors. And then we look at how do their behaviors align with their values, right? Are your behaviors supporting your values, or do your behaviors, you know, help you achieve your values, or, you know, or whatever, right? Because if your behaviors, you know, if I say I value being healthy, but I never exercise or I never eat healthy food, you know, then my behaviors don't align with what I say are my values. And so as far as confronting your biases, that's something that, you know, you can do as a sort of like a private self-reflective type activity, right? Look at what are your values and then how are your behaviors aligning with them, right? It could be things like what Ms. Gail is saying there. Are you financially supporting organizations that do secular social justice work? Do you participate in any kind of, do you do anything secular social justice related at all? You know, or do you just, you know, share memes? you know, because if you say you support secular social justice movements, you do these things, you know, you care about it, you this, that, the third, but you literally do nothing, you know, then, mm-hmm. you know, then you know, your values and your behaviors aren't aligning.
Right.
And then, you know, as far as, you know, how, looking at how your religious indoctrination, you know, can actually play a role into, you know, into your history, which are racism, classism, sexism, stuff. Obviously, you know, at least from, you know, sort of our Judeo-Christian, you know, religious, religion, you know, that's obvious how those, you know, the foundations that Old Testament, that God of the Old Testament, you know, was a very racist, you know, classist, sexist, you know, all of the above God, right? And so if you bought into any of that to any significant degree, you know, it's not hard to see how that got into you. I know, for example, for me, one of the things that when I was a minister and when I was very active in the church, one of the things that was very big to us was the whole idea of submission, that women had to submit to their husbands. If you didn't have a husband, you had to submit to your father, you know, that sort of thing. Like, that was a huge deal. You know, I'm not married anymore, but once when I was still married, my husband and I both kind of came out of religion at the same time. We were both deconverting at the same time. But that was something that we were having to figure out how to shake off, this whole idea of, you know, what did this sort of submission thing really mean? And like, what was our relationship with or without, you know, submission? How did our relationship play out with that? And so you got to, you know, you really got to assess those things. And of course, you know, again, as a mental health professional, you know, I'm going to recommend that you go and, you know, see a therapist, that you go talk to somebody. You know, but it just depends on what level are you, right? Are you really working through trauma? If you're really in a traumatized place and you're still really working through traumatic experiences, that sort of thing, then you need to be working with a therapist. You know, that's where you need to start out right now. You know, yes, you know, maybe doing some activist work might help you sort of channel some of that energy, but you really do need to be healing yourself, because you can get into activism and actually end up doing more harm than good if you're not taking care of yourself. But you know, if you're taking care of yourself, you're feeling pretty good, and you're just really ready to kind of confront those biases, this stuff like this education is key. Coming and participating, coming to conferences, coming to Black non-believers conferences, reading the books, you know, these sorts of things. Like, you know, all of this stuff, the education is key. I'm big on education. I'm always going to say educate yourself. I'm always going to say get some therapy and educate yourself. Those are always going to be my big things. And listen to people, you know, if you're trying to, you know, listen to the despised groups, whatever the despised group is. If you're trying to deal with sexism, listen to, you know, women. Or the non-dominant genders, which is anything other than male, right? You know, if you're trying to deal with classism, you know, you're gonna have to listen to anything other than rich. So you've got to really sort of put yourself in the place of accessing information and accessing the population or the people that you're trying to learn from.
Candace, if I may ask, I'm hearing a lot about how constant and incessant this fear and anger is within the Black community. And I also know that statistics show that the Black community have a significantly lower life expectancy than compared to folks, you know, white folks. Could this psychological, this could these mental all of the fear and anger that is that the Black community face on a daily basis, could that be a big portion of why life expectancy is so low?
Well, I think that it could probably contribute to it. You know, when we think about stress, anxiety, depression, and how that impacts cortisol levels, you know, all of those, anytime you got any of those stressors and how those, you know, impact, you know, they affect they have negative impacts on cardiovascular health. Like, you know, I mentioned earlier, they impact, that chronic stress does have those negative impacts on the, you know, those, you know, body systems, right? Like I said, the cardiovascular system, causing that, you know, excessive cortisol levels in the body, you know, high blood pressure, you know, from the chronic stress. So absolutely, I mean, I think just being under chronic stress like that will and can contribute to it. You know, it can contribute to, of course, you know, issues with pregnancy. You know, while you're pregnant, being under that chronic stress can contribute to issues, you know, while you're pregnant in that area, and, you know, ending up with, you know, preterm labor and stuff like that. So, you know,
this has all put us at higher risk. You know, this is what when we are talking about the institutional and structural factors, it does put us at higher health risks. And also, you know, there's also, even if you aren't directly affected by the socioeconomic factor, because it has been so ingrained in our society that it may be affecting us when we don't realize it. Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I get another question. Is there a portion of the Black population who may perhaps think, if I can be white enough, if I can mimic the white culture enough, then maybe I can, these feelings of fear and anger will go away? Like, maybe if I can do what the cool kids are doing or whatever, that I would be accepted. Is there a portion of the population that feels that way?
So at one point historically, and this is what I referred to earlier about the internalization of white supremacy, even when there is a mass mistrust. So there were a number of Black folks either during, now let's go back to the enslavement period, where the slave masters basically raped some of their slaves and had children. So, you know, though those children may have been given better treatment because they may have come out more lighter skinned. And so, yes, there is this inherent idea that white supremacy throughout the world has tried to convey that the lighter or whiter you are, the more opportunities you have. And of course, and once again, the darker you are, no matter where you are, the worse you will be treated. And it used to be more overt, but now it has become more internalized. So yes, there are maybe a significant portion of Black folks who have internalized this idea that perhaps maybe if I was white, then I wouldn't have to deal with this. And that comes from, you know, years of being oppressed and subjugated, because, you know, there's this idea that we enjoy suffering, and I don't, you know, that isn't true. You know, who enjoys actually being, you know, being oppressed to where you have to be worried about your livelihood. So yes, there might have been, you know, we can definitely attest to whether it was said outright or whether it was through the actions of our grandparents or some of our other ancestors. You know, absolutely, that's a thing. But that is a result of the systemic oppression.
I tell you what, I think you probably will hear a lot. Now, brace yourself. You know, I'm going to be raw. I think what you might hear is people saying, if I get enough money, right, I can get away from these niggas.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can move to a nice neighborhood. I can drive a nice car. I can get to a nice gated community where I know it's going to be safe. I ain't got to live, I ain't got to worry about X, Y, Z, blah, 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 blah. You know what I'm saying? So I think maybe they don't, maybe they won't say, I want to be white, but they're going to say, if I can get me enough money, then I can get away from the niggas.
Yeah, it's a lot of internalized, definitely some internalization there.
Yep. And then they can get to a nice neighborhood, which is, getting away from the niggas is the same thing as I'm going to get to a nice neighborhood and get away from, you know, and there might be a couple of black people in the nice neighborhood, but you know, when you saying you're going to get you some money and you're going to move to a nice gated community and you're going to drive your nice car and you're going to blah, 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 you don't expect there to be as many white people in those communities.
Any black, more black,
I mean, yeah, you don't expect there to be as many black people in that.
Now, we're not going to say that just because, you know, we were enslaved in this country that we aren't human beings, that there were never conflicts. You know, there's going to be conflicts within human beings no matter where you go. And it's no different with black folks. It's no, you know, we don't all share the same views. We all don't share the same ideology, especially nowadays. Not everyone has grown up with that sense of struggle that most of our, maybe perhaps our parents or our grandmothers and grandfathers endured. So there's definitely, there's been discourse. There's always been discourse. There's no, you know, whether we were enslaved in this country or not, it would have been, you know, but it has definitely been exacerbated by this idea that somehow, you know, you have to be better than those people, whether you realize it or not. It could be, you may not even realize that you're doing it or saying it, but somehow you are better off than those people. And so it's time for people to, you know, really reassess that and be honest about that, about what they may have thought. That perhaps, well, yeah, I may not have to deal with it like those folks over there, or I don't have to be like them. So yeah, we're moving to the section now, and I know we've talked about this all throughout this presentation as to how can racial injustice be better addressed and resolved. And yes, the first thing to do is to make sure that you are educated. Make sure you are better educated beyond what your, you know, beyond your formal education. Because there's a lot to be said about disparities, especially in poor communities in this country. But there's something to be said about an educational system, even from those who are privileged, for those who do not understand the institutional and structural aspects of racism, or even their own internal racism, or their own internal prejudices. So it's good to be educated. And, you know, I saw all of these pictures. I got all of these pictures from social media, because these are from current protests that are taking place right now. And I think all of them have significant meaning, and they're all relatable to show that you're not so far removed to where you cannot be a part of the solution. There's something that we can all do here, whether you are out in front protesting, or whether, because some of us have familial situations or households where we cannot be out just protesting outright. And that's understandable. That doesn't mean you can't do your part, whether it is to, you know, be gathering, hopefully safely, or hopefully safely, excuse me, you know, and protesting and getting those. These are all, I thought, were very, very good. And especially this last one, for the white folks who have an issue with the Black Lives Matter campaign. You know, and this idea that you don't have to care about Black lives, or it doesn't matter to you because you're white. It trust me, it affects all of us. And there may be someone in your family, you know, yes, if you go back to the continent of Africa. That is, yes, that is definitely where we all originated from. So guess what? We're more alike than you realize. So, but yes, these are the things that you can actually do. Now, these systems took place, you know, these systems took time to implement. We can't go back in the past and actually do anything about that. But there are things we can do now. You know, there are things that we can continue to learn and unlearn now and actually put our money where our mouths are when it comes to addressing and trying to resolve these issues together. And these are some of the very simple that now for very simple things that we can and should do, it, you know, at all possible. So I just, you know, this is how we can better, it's going to take that time and it's going to have to be as systemic as these other institutions were implemented. So Candace, would you like to say anything else about that?
I remember the other day I happened to hear Toni Morrison, I believe it was Toni Morrison. It was an old clip from like the early 90s or something, where she was doing an interview and she said something like, you know, somebody had asked her, you know, what do we need to do? And she said something to the effect of like, Black people don't need to do anything. Like, we didn't put ourselves in this situation. We didn't get ourselves in this situation. Y'all got us in this situation. But we don't need to do anything. Y'all need to fix this. And I was just like, man, snaps, you know, like that was right on time. And it's like, you know, people keep asking, what do we need to do with it? Like, you know what you need to do. You just don't really want to do the things that right. you need to do. Like, the things that need to be done are hard to do. The things that need to be done are expensive. The things that need to be doing that need to be done are radical, right? They require like overhauls of the criminal justice system. They require like spending equal money in the education system. You know, they require things like, you know, spending equal money in the healthcare system. You know, they require things like not killing us by the police. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, you know the things to do. It's just that the stuff is so deeply ingrained in the system, you have to confront your daddies and your granddaddies who have control of the system, you know, who's the president and the vice president and the governors and the, you know, and the justices and the, like, you have to go confront the powers that be to make those changes and then put money where your mouth is, and that stuff is harder. And so people come asking us, like, like there's something that's easier or cheaper to do. And it's not, you know, go confront your racist family members, you know, go, like, now, mind you, we got to vote. We need to vote because we need to start voting. Now, that's my own feet. Now, I'll take that back to my people and I'll fuss at my people about voting and doing their part to, like, change things. But, you know what you need to do. You know what things it takes to change a system. It's just that those things are hard and there's no easy workaround, you know, and I just really loved that when I saw Toni Morrison say that, you know, it was like, I don't need to do anything because I didn't get myself in this situation. You know, you got me in this situation. So it's not my responsibility to fix a situation that I didn't get myself into.
Right. And there's nuance and there's a differentiation between, you know, personal accountability in our lives and then also the systemic right. factors. So we need to right. understand that what they are and you know, how we all, you know, how we all play our parts in doing this. You know, because yes, Black folks have shouldered the unfair burden of always having to, you know, of always having to, for our blood, sweat, and tears, first in building this country, pretty much against our will, for nothing. And so, and then there is still this idea that, well, we still have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps even though, mm-hmm. you know, we weren't given any boots to begin with, or the boots we were given were run down. So try putting it in those, you know, try thinking about it in those terms, you know, as a collective community. So finally, I'm going to give some reminders here because I know we're running down on time and we want to get to the discussions. So yes, do try to do assess your mental health. You know, do assess your mental health. A lot of what we're seeing now does take a toll on us. It's taking a toll on our emotions as we engage people. And sometimes those discussions can get heated. You know, it is best to really, really think about where you are and how this is affecting you. Also, do engage your communities. And I'm going to take this back to the talk I did a couple of weeks back about utilizing your support networks. Because now is a time more important than ever, especially if you are out there, if you are on the front lines of either engaging more directly, protesting, and if as you engage more in, you know, into the activist work, you know, you're gonna have to you're really gonna have to we're gonna have to lean on each other for that support. And in reminder, like Candace said, you know, do take care of yourself, because we don't need any more people dying right now unnecessarily, whether it is at the hands of law enforcement or whether it is at the hands of us not seeing to our physical, mental, and overall health. So we have to try to take better care of ourselves as well as each other, especially in this time, because as we do look for more evidence-based solutions to these problems that we have, and trying to undo these structure, you know, these structural systems, and trying to revise them and turn them around, this is gonna be really, really important. So these three aspects are really, they're gonna be crucial in how we continue to maneuver into the future. So if there is nothing else, we'd like to thank you all very much for joining us for this discussion. The chat room looks very lively. And so, you know, if Candace, if you have anything to end, you know, in this session, you know, I really appreciate you joining. You know, this was great. Candace is often one of our featured speakers at our events. And as well as Daryl too. So, you know, it's very good to have, you know, to be able to have these conversations and also just, you know, continue to, you know, continue this work, because this is a part of the activism as well. The more we can engage in this type of discussion and this type of dialogue, the more hopefully people will take this back and actually implement it.
Excellent. Candace, Mandisa, thank you so, so much for having this conversation with us. If you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and stop the, perfect. Excellent. Okay. Again, thank you so much for joining us here. We have received a few questions. If you've got a question for Mandisa or Candace, please type it in the chat. So Amaya, you want to take the first one?
Yeah. So the first one is related to mental health. So the question is, how can Black people who may struggle to come out with mental health struggles in their communities, who may not be understanding of mental health issues, how can they do it in a way that is safe and that they, you know, they're not going to get a bad reaction from them?
So the question is, how can they come out about it?
Yeah, so how can they share their mental health struggles in a way that is safe, that doesn't put them in danger of, you know, either being made fun of or just getting kicked out, not kicked out, but you know what I mean, of the community or you know, getting alienated?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, you don't have to share anything that you don't want to share. You know, if you're seeking therapy or if you're talking to a mental health professional, don't share anything with anybody that you don't want to share, point blank period. You know, and then slowly over time, if you begin to feel the need to share, you know, what you do or, you know, what you're doing sort of as a testament, you know, sort of as a way to kind of encourage other people, you know, then that might be something that you do. But just to sort of feel like you just kind of got to do it because you got to come out of the closet, so to speak. You got to come out of the mental health closet. You got to come out of the mental health closet. Yeah, nobody needs to know what you're doing or what you're not doing. You know, like I said, I'm open. I'm a therapist. I see a therapist. I take medications. It helps me. It stabilizes me. I cannot do and be who I am today. Would it not be for the work that I've done professionally and the medications that I take? Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. That is my testimony to you. Praise Jesus. Okay. So I recommend it very much. If you need it, take it. Mm-hmm. But do not feel like you got to say, when I first started seeing a therapist, I kid you not, when I first started seeing a therapist and the first time that I ever took an antidepressant, I told my mom, and I was like, and you better not tell nobody else. I literally was like, don't you tell nobody that I'm taking a medicine and I'm seeing a therapist. Don't tell nobody in our family. Like, I didn't want nobody to know. Mm-hmm. It was so embarrassing and it was so scary to me. And I didn't want nobody to know. And now here I am years later on Zoom, like, I don't care what, who knows what I think. Because it's been life-changing. It has literally saved my life. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to share, don't share.
Right. Period. Yes. Mm-hmm. And getting over this idea that you absolutely, you know, have to absolutely have to share that. Or, you know, yeah, it's good to do it on your time. You know, you have to be comfortable with yourself. You don't have to feel embarrassed for doing it, because there are a lot of Black folks who feel embarrassed at the idea of seeing a therapist. Or, you know, there are, you know, because there was a time where the medical community, you know, has done, you know, there is a mistrust of the medical community or medication or medical practices within the Black community. And I think that's unlearning a part of that. You know, about a part of that structure. And it really is good for us to get over that. So, I mean, I'm currently, you know, seeing a therapist as a part of my self-care this year, because my work has, and my life has determined that I needed it. And I'm okay with that. You know, I don't feel, you know, embarrassed as a result. So yes, absolutely.
Can I jump in here, because we're gonna we lose a few people right after the social or this starts, and I just want to emphasize, you can donate to Black non-believers, and I think you, if you're looking for things to do, as Candace and has already mentioned and Mandisa, it's an amazing organization doing a lot of good work, and they can use every dollar they need. So.
Yes, we appreciate everyone who has been donating to us, especially as of late. And we appreciate, you know, we can always use much more. So, but yes, thank you all very, very much. And I appreciate, you know, thank you for the plug, and also do support Recovering From Religion as well. But yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you said reminded me of this, like, statistic about the NHS, which is the healthcare system in the UK. In which Black people receive a lot less attention than any other race. And even if the NHS is free, it's not dependent on how much income you have, it's completely free. But Black people still suffer from professionals of the health services not being as understanding or not paying attention to that. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. And then following up with the loneliness kind of concept, how can a Black person who lives in an area which is mostly white find a community in which, as you kind of said, you don't have to explain yourself or you can be relaxed? How can they find, a healthy way of finding a community?
Well, that's Mandisa's wheelhouse all day.
Oh, yeah. So absolutely. A lot of people, it starts by you know, doing your research online, looking for groups. Now, I will say that Black Nonbelievers in particular is not the type of organization that qualifies our Blackness, because that is and there are some folks who may have an issue with me saying this, because this is also a byproduct of the internalized supremacy, that this idea of what it means to be Black, that if you grew up in a white neighborhood and you didn't grow up, you know, surrounded by a bunch of Black folks, that somehow you are not of the community. And that simply isn't true. You know, there are Black folks of all kinds, and we understand the diversity within our own community. And, you know, it's good to start, and we encourage people to feel comfortable wherever they are. You know, mm-hmm. if you are comfortable with where you are, then you find community there. However, mm-hmm. if you are looking to find, if you are looking to, you know, definitely engage more in Black spaces, you may have to venture out a bit more. I am a huge advocate for going beyond your comfort zone, mm-hmm. and maybe going out a little bit further, perhaps more, you know, maybe more now once it's more safe to do so. It is very important that if you are really seeking that community, you make sure you find it, and you may have to vet more than one. You know, don't just get turned off if you have a bad experience with one. Mm-hmm. You may have to shop around a bit. So, mm-hmm. you know, and there's plenty of spaces to do that online until you can take it offline and in person. But even if you do that, you know, just try to, you know, get your bearings. You may have to go out a little bit further and be comfortable doing that. And hopefully you'll establish enough relationships and friendships to where, you know, there is reciprocal engagement. So just starting there and putting it out there and looking for a meetup is a good place to start for that. You know, there are all types mm-hmm. of groups, and usually you'll find at least one secular group in your area, even if it is a small town. You may have to go just a little bit further out, but being willing to do that is going to be important.
And you gave a great talk about that not more than 2 weeks ago here at RFRX also, and I will go ahead and link that in the chat, your talk 2 weeks ago. Candace, how would one emotionally support their partner who is having a lot of anxiety with and depression with what's going on currently?
How to support your partner. Oh gosh, that's such a difficult one, because you know, of course, one, you don't want to run the risk of trying to become your partner's therapist. So depending on how significant the issues are, you know, I'll keep going back to it, right? If they're going to a really dark place, they need to go see a professional, right? I'm going to keep saying that. But, you know, it's always important to listen, you know, to listen. I guess it really just depends on where they are. Do they, you know, if they are the type of person who will talk, and if they talk, then listen. You know, if they don't talk, it's hard to kind of give advice about a person. It just depends on the person. But I think, you know, the main thing is about just being there and being patient. You know, not pushing a person to be like, oh, I want to talk. Tell me what's wrong. I'm here for you. You know, not doing that, just kind of making sure that they know that you're open and that you're available for them, you know, and just kind of being a space and being available to them. You know, and not constantly, you know, trying to pry into their mind and that sort of thing. But, you know, I don't know, you know, it depends person to person. I think just, like I said, the main thing is just if the person is really dark, you know, if they're really going into a dark place, it's really important to try to encourage them to get some professional help, because you don't want to get sucked into, you know, you ending up in a dark place yourself, you trying to be a person's part, you know, therapist. You know, you definitely don't want to end up in a place like that. You know, you can support somebody, you can be there for them emotionally. You know, you guys can talk, you can share, y'all can cry together if necessary. You know, you can do those types of things. But if they're having crying spells, you know, on a regular basis, if they're having panic attacks, you know, if they're talking about, you know, life doesn't seem like it has meaning anymore, or, you know, if they're really just dropping hints that they seem like they're going into a really dark place, these are signs, you know, that they really need to be seeing somebody professionally, because it's really gone beyond, you know, what you should be trying to deal with on your own.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Candace.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.